The teaching you are about to receive has been freely offered to support your practice. If you would like to make a donation to support the continuation of our work, please visit us at awakenedheartproject.org.
Well, tonight we're doing Reconceptionism 102. It's called Karma, Suffering, and Sacred Intention. Or the metaphysical musings of a megalomaniacal mixed-up mystic. Sometimes in the Buddhist world it's called yogi mind, potentially anyways, which is a state that happens to people on meditation retreats where they sometimes think they're having brilliant insights. And it's usually a sign that concentration is out of balance with awareness. Like when those things get out of balance, that can happen. So I think we need a Jewish term for yogi mind, but I haven't figured it out yet. Like maybe helm mind. So for some of you, this would be a good time to go to sleep. I didn't get to do the gematria for karma, the mystical number of karma. But, okay. Well, you can figure out the number and let me know, but it's what it's equal to. That's where it gets interesting. Okay. So there's a lot of doctrine around karma, a lot of dogma, a lot of dark doctrine. And when I go on retreat, I've sort of been... I gave a karma talk once before. I've been in the 15 years of giving talks, I tried it once. It's on my note. It says in 2004 I did it once. So... when I go on retreats in the Buddhist world, I've sat with lots of different teachers, and they give these kinds of talks at night, and I always think they're brilliant. I mean, pretty much everywhere I've gone, you know, I just listen to all these talks, and I'm just amazed at how wise they are. And then on lots of retreats, somebody will then give a talk on karma. And it's the only time when these guys, these men and women who I think are really brilliant, it's the only talk I hear always, I think, no, I don't believe that. But I think it's certainly important to talk about suffering, and in the serious title for the talk, I want to talk about karma in terms of suffering and intentions, the role of sacred intentions, holy intentions. And that's the piece I actually was most drawn to. I was trying to, the piece on intention. That's when I stopped my metaphysical musings, that's the part that will be really serious tonight. I mean, the other part I'm serious about, but this will be the more practically valuable part, is working with intentions. I should have said to Brian, I want you to talk on intentions. He mentioned that conversation, I think, briefly in his talk. But then on Monday, I started five different talks or so on Monday. I got into each one a little bit, and just they weren't going anywhere. And so I came back to this. So the topics I want to talk about tonight are big karma, immediate karma. They're a little different. And cause and effect, which is basically what karma is. And I'm going to talk about intentions. I'm going to talk about the connection between that and suffering and happiness. And the connection between cause and effect, intentions, karma, and happiness in the present moment, how it all works in the present moment. I'm going to talk about watching on retreat and the key teaching. I'll repeat it a few times, but the whole key to that is just restraint. Our restraint practice is the key to how we can do this work. And we're doing all sorts of restraint practices here, like silence, like not getting up, not doing all sorts of things you might normally do. I want to talk about evaluating the outcomes as we watch what's happening moment to moment. conditioning intentions, cultivating sacred intention, checking profane intentions, bringing wisdom to mundane intentions. So basically, karma is cause and effect. So what we're really just going to look at tonight is the sort of the laws of cause and effect, and how they apply to suffering and to liberation. Now, from a Buddhist point of view, you'd say to how the laws of cause and effect, how they relate to suffering and liberation. And I wrote down happiness, so I think I'm a little bit more interested in thinking about suffering and happiness. And I'm not going to really focus on liberation, which is a key piece of the Buddhist teachings and a key piece of the karma, the reason karma has to be talked about in the ultimate liberation. And I think that's where it gets messy. I think it's less messy if we talk about happiness. So I want to talk about... But the suffering piece we all are concerned about. I think everybody is concerned about the suffering in the world, and I think most of us at times certainly think about why good people suffer. Like that question, you know, what's going on in this world? And in the Buddhist world, there's a tendency, when they talk about karma, to fall back into reincarnation. So that's the added piece of cause and effect. And they'll talk about reincarnation that is somehow a needed variable to talk about the mess of the world we live in, why things are distributed the way they are. Doesn't quite make sense without, somehow it doesn't seem to make sense without talking about reincarnation. So I'm going to tackle reincarnation a little bit, but just enough to perhaps leave open the possibility that we could keep somewhat of an open mind about it. And mostly, and after I talk about it a little bit, I'll try to ignore it and look at my life and your life and our more immediate lives. But I did want to do a little bit about it. So I thought we'd get, you know, the details of reincarnation out of the way, so to speak. So this morning, I thought I should figure out how reincarnation works. So I missed a couple of sits today, so because I was busy figuring out reincarnation. And it might have been a good idea if I gave this talk at 5:30, which is that's when I understood it. This morning when I was fresh and I knew what I was talking about. But I took some notes, so maybe it'll come through here. So I want to tell one story. How many of you heard this story? But it's just a story that will help us frame the exploration. Or you know, that there's an urgency to the exploration somehow. So there's a teaching about, that's another teaching about the Baal Shem Tov. Somebody wrote me a note, said, tell as many Baal Shem Tov stories as you can. So the Baal Shem Tov story. And it's a story about, he went to a town one day in his travels, and he came to when he got to the town, the sort of the most respected people in the town invited him to spend Shabbat there, so he was in their house with them for Shabbat. They had a young son named Mendel. Again, some of you have heard this a bunch of times. So they had a young son named Mendel, who was about 17 years old, and Mendel lived in the corner. Mendel, from birth on, had never been able to walk or talk, and he slept in a bed in the corner of the house, and they took care of him. That was their responsibility, and anyways, they were hosting the Baal Shem Tov, and since they wanted to honor the Baal Shem Tov, the head of the house decided to serve a goose for Shabbat. He was going to be there on the Sabbath, so he decided to slaughter a goose, because it was really a delicacy and a treat, and so he killed the goose, and he cut it open, and he was looking at the insides of the goose, and he saw some blemishes on the internal organs. So that means there's a possibility that the goose is not kosher. It depends, but you have to sort of know what is and what isn't. And he figured the Baal Shem Tov's at his house, so rather than go to the local rabbi or try to figure it out himself, he would just show the Baal Shem Tov. the goose. So he takes the goose into the house where Baal Shem Tov is, and he shows him the goose, and he asks him whether whether the goose is kosher or not, and the Baal Shem Tov turns over and looks at Mendel. He says, "Mendel, come over here." Mendel gets up and shakily leaves the bed, gets up shakily, walks over to where the Baal Shem Tov is. And the Baal Shem Tov says to him, "So Mendel, is this goose a treif or kosher?" Treif means not kosher. Treif or kosher? And Mendel looks at it and he goes, "Kosher." And he drops dead. And the parents are completely flabbergasted. They've never seen their son move before, so they were, and speak before, and here's the first time he did it, and this next second he's dead. So the Baal Shem Tov said to them, probably not with humor. He said to them, "Well, really, you don't have to worry about that. I mean, let me tell you what's really going on here. I know it's distressing to you, but he said, in his last life, your son was a very, very famous rabbi. He was a great sage and very learned and knew the mystical texts and beloved. And one day on a Friday afternoon, he was busy studying the sacred texts and reading the books and learning. And a poor woman came to his house who had just slaughtered a chicken. And the chicken had some blemishes inside, and she showed the chicken to Mendel, and he was sort of caught up in his books, not really paying careful attention. So he quickly looked over and at the chicken, and he wasn't sure, actually. He wasn't sure either. So he said, "Treif, no good." And the poor woman went home, and she didn't have any much food for the Sabbath. She couldn't afford another chicken, and that was a great sin. This rabbi had committed a great sin, because there's a rule in Jewish law, which is when it comes to poor people, whenever somebody is in need, if there's a question like that and there's any doubt, then you always decide on the lenient side. If it wasn't kosher, it wasn't kosher. That's another story. But if there's any doubt, you always decide on the lenient side to help the poor. And that was a terrible sin. And it was the only thing he ever did wrong in his whole life. So when he came back, he had to come back to fix it up. So when he came back into this life, and he got born as your son, he figured, why take a chance and mess it up again? So he just sort of bided his time and waited until the right moment came to finish the work he needed to do here. So, your son's now in heaven. He completed what he needed to do on this earth plane. So, it's a story that I think is a story that points us to say we don't know. You know, who's to say how this is all working? Except for me, I'm going to tell you how it's all working. But who's to say how? Not really how it's all working. I'll get to that point. But who's to say? Who knows? Who can see what? There's stuff we don't know and can't see. So I want to tell you what came to me today as I was thinking about. Sort of the question of, what reincarnates, actually. I felt like I had to start by thinking about what incarnates. What is incarnate? Where are you going to reincarnate? What is incarnation altogether? What is that? So, I'm obviously going to use this model that we've been talking about for the last week and a half. But as you might see, I added just a couple things that are going to be helpful as we start to think about this model, too. So I added this graphic down here, which we traditionally think of as the yin-yang, the picture of the yin-yang, because I think it's really, I think it's a better representation of Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. I think it's a way of understanding this name, understanding the process that I've been talking about for the last 10 days. This is a much better representation of what it looks like, and how it operates than drawing it in that way, which has its benefits drawing that way, because it looks like a human being and it's sort of saying we're created in God's image, so it's lovely to do it that way. But I think the reality is much more like this, that the Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh is not linear. I think it's wrong to think of these four worlds as linear, so not in some sort of linear unfolding. They're much more like the yin and the yang, where and the similarities are so great, because the this whole section, which sort of looks just like this whole section, it's like the hay. You have the letter hay. You know, this everything that's black is the letter hay, everything that's white is the letter hay. And then you have the vav that connects those two hays. This whole line is the vav that connects the two hays. And then you get to the you get to like this point here and this point here. I was thinking about this today. You know, the dot being here and here, that's just a representation. In some ways it looks nice that way. But the dot, it's not like the dot is right there, right here. In fact, the dot represents, this dot represents sort of this point, and this dot represents sort of this point. And a point has no location in space. That's what it means, a point. No location in time or space, actually. So we conveniently, for drawing purposes, and I think because it looks nice, we put it there, but really all it's saying is that some point of this is inside some point of this. And they're all completely interconnected anyways. I think it'd be, if you could do it three-dimensional somehow when you got to this point, it would be sort of coming back around and into this point, you know? If you know what I'm talking about, you can see what I'm saying. So, that's why putting it here, you sort of miss that. In some ways, it's here, but it's not anywhere. It's not about space. But so that's an important conceptual way of the reconception. So one more reconception of in this process of reconceptualizing our name for the divine. So. In that sense, these worlds, it's not quite valid to talk. I think it's helpful in a certain way to talk about these as separate worlds, but they're not completely separate. They inter-are, these worlds. You sort of more like this. This captures the interrelationship of the four worlds. That's why I like that. It's an amazing symbol. I know. It's interesting to know who thought that up somehow, you know? Some human being figured this out somewhere. I assume. I actually don't know how it happened, but imagine. Maybe he was sitting on a retreat. So the world sort of, they have some aspects of separateness and some aspects of coexistence. So that's why I wanted to tell that story about the baby chicks, that experiment with the baby chicks. I think it actually points to sort of understanding that there's the world of love. Now I'm going to sort of, just for shorthand purposes, I'm going to call this world, which we've been talking about, its name is in Hebrew is Yetzira, which means formed, which is just like formed in the Buddhist text. But for shorthand, I'm going to talk about this world as love, and I'm going to talk about this world as wisdom. But I sort of, it's a little bit limited. As concepts are limited, but so I wanted to tell that story about that experiment that David talked, that Tapper showed me, because it points to the fact that love is sort of another world of reality. Inter is with other worlds, but it has its own rules, so to speak. That's what I think was nice about that teaching. So. It was the rule that sort of was manifesting in that story, at least how I understand that experiment, is different than gravity. And gravity things attract too, but and so in this world, in Asiya, so gravity is the rule of attraction. But the rule of attraction in this world is, it's different. It's like a different set of rules. I think the core rule, and I'm not pretending I know all the rules, but I think the core rule, one of the core rules, in that world is that's different than in the physical plane is the rule that hatred is never cured by hatred but by love alone. This is the universal truth. That's a teaching. I think that's a rule of that world. It doesn't apply to atoms. It's not about atoms exactly. But these worlds aren't separate. So hatred is sort of a different world than physicality. Hatred, love, talking about, but it's still a conditioned world. It still has rules. It operates with rules. So I think there are aspects of the realm, and I'm going to just call this the realm of wisdom. I think there, so just like the world of love has some rules that aren't exactly of physicality. So the world of wisdom also has aspects to it. There are aspects of the world of physicality that you wouldn't—they're not exactly the same as being as physical being. Just like love isn't exactly the same as Adam. So there's aspects of the world of wisdom that sort of—it's somewhat helpful to call it a separate world, a unique world. But it's a unique world, just like this whole thing is. Is too. So it has some separateness to it, has some interconnectivity. So the language that I was using here actually is that I think what happens is that wisdom gets embodied. There is a way that wisdom becomes embodied. Another way to say that would be that wisdom mutually calls physicality into being. Like wisdom calls physicality into being, and vice versa. That physicality is calling wisdom into being. And these things come in; they co-come into being. And it manifests that physicality takes on certain structures. That physicality itself takes on certain structures in order that wisdom can manifest in it. Which is how it draws wisdom into it. But it takes on those characteristics because wisdom was helping the design get physicality to do that so that it could be embodied there. Mm-hmm. So physicality creates sense organs in order that wisdom could inhabit physicality. It creates brains so that in order that wisdom could inhabit physicality. The brain chemistry shapes wisdom, which designed the brain chemistry. So they co-arose. They're not separate linear events. That's why I wanted to get away from the linear picture. Wisdom is shaped by what's happening in matter. Havaya is unfolding, meaning growing. Havaya is expanding. And the word which I talked about in my talk last Friday night, I think it was from Ezekiel, where it says, God says, I will magnify myself in the world. In other words, I'm going to enlarge myself in physicality by having wisdom grow in physicality. But and Havaya is both of them, it's not one or the other. The wise design of the universe arranges for what seems like random mutations of genes in a pull to expand itself. This often makes unviable results that sort of don't fit the law of being, but it also sometimes makes things like Homo sapiens. So wisdom is expanding itself through physicality. As we go, patterns of wisdom are inexorably drawn into physical being. The same is true with love. So love is the connective force, too. Love is the connective force that links the worlds, that matches wisdom and physicality. So you could say that when two parents make love, they're attracting a pattern of wisdom. So the physicality attracts a pattern, and the love energy, or whatever energy, I mean, I'm not trying to be simple or Pollyanna-ish about it, but the emotional energy of that coming together also attracts, not just physicality that's attracting wisdom, that's all interhappening. So love is also calling forth patterns of wisdom, you know, sub-pieces of this wisdom. Because this wisdom is still an aggregate world, just like this is an aggregate world. These three worlds are all still aggregate worlds, meaning they have a wholeness, but they're also made up of parts, so to speak. The parts are much more distinct in this world and knowable as distinct, but they're still an aggregate world. I think when we get up into Atzilut, you're not talking about an aggregate world anymore. Now there's a world of undifferentiated. So there's no coming together of different things. I haven't yet figured out if it's different than the unborn, the ingredient. I think there's one more level. At least according to our mystics, there's one more thing to be figured out that I didn't get yet. I just haven't figured that out for myself yet, what I think about that. But I've been working on that. I mean, there's something about this And then I think there's something else yet, that which is the totally unborn, uncreated, unformed, unconditioned. But that's another talk, I suppose. So with the chicks, as much as it was sort of the chicks' love, in parentheses, or in quotes, that attracted the computer chips, it was the love itself that drew both of them into being. Love itself drew chicks into being and computers into being. And love sort of drew wisdom into experimenting with chicks, to answer this question. Everything was pulling each other into being. And the whole thing is arising in infinite awareness. We can't see the whole picture because of our limit. We have limited sense organs. We only have six senses, so we can't see this whole picture. But everything's arising everything that arises in dependent origination, with invisible lines of connection. That's the title of a book Larry Kushner wrote: Invisible Lines of Connection. Sometimes we get glimpses of the line. Sometimes we get glimpses of the connection. But the first time I noticed it really explicitly was when I took psychedelic mushrooms. The first time I took psychedelic mushrooms, at one point, a number of things happened, but at one point I was sitting and watching the mountains, and I noticed that there was a cloud passing through the sky at exactly the same speed as a thought was passing through my mind. I mean, I could watch the thought and watch the cloud. They were not separate phenomena. It was really clear. It's completely clear as could be. That they were co-happening. They weren't in every aspect. They were the same thing moving in both places. So we just don't see it all the time. We don't have the a perceptive mass, and that's the word it is, for seeing these things. Because we only have six senses. Then I was thinking, I think said this earlier, maybe we have seven senses. We have a sense for love. I mean, we know love. So maybe that's a seventh sense. And we know wisdom, too, actually. When it's present, it's recognizable. One of the things I notice on retreat is when it comes and goes. Sometimes it's so clear when it's gone. It's like it was there a little while ago. It's not there. So maybe we're limited to only perceiving page one of Zoom. That's the best we can do. But that doesn't mean it's not all out there. So, and then even those kind of glimpses get to the cloud and the thought. It all gets reduced to concepts. So by the time I'm telling it to you, whatever it was, now it's just a conceptual reporting of that, which also limits. So I'm reducing metaphysical insights into concepts. But I'm trying to work with them with mostly good intention to be helpful. Mm. And if I pay attention to my insight, intentions that are arising also, there's also some intention to have fun with pleasant mental activity. I mean, mostly the intention was to be helpful, I think, as far as I could see, and it was a lot of fun. It definitely was fun to do that, so that was pleasant. And there was some intention of clinging about how this will go over, wanting to be seen in a certain way. So all of that was happening today. So when we look at intentions, we have to try to be sophisticated. Picture of causes and effects co-arising. The teaching of the Buddha is that you can't try to figure out where it started. That's sort of the piece of the great, you could call it God or the first origin. Like, where did this all come from? That's one of the great imponderables. And so are the details about. You can tell that story about Mendel, but generally what the Buddha said is the details about which in that story, the details are revealed, so to speak. But generally what the Buddha said is the details are way beyond the comprehension of a human mind. Because basically, it makes sense because you're basically talking about everything that happened since, every single event that happened since the Big Bang. That's why it's unfolding the way it is now. That's not, that's not comprehensible by the human mind. So, and the Buddha said that pondering such things leads to insanity. Whoever speculates about them would go mad and experience vexation. So some part of this world of Brihya, which is an aggregate world, is influenced by what happens in human life. Reincarnation, though, is not personal. So that's certainly the first thing about it. It's not personal. The stuff that reincarnates is certainly not the personality, which is a limited collection of mental aggregates and the mental aggregates of that kind of personality, I think, are happening, you know, mostly in this world altogether. The kind of thinking that we call "I want this" is not what's happening in the world of wisdom. In that sense, thinking is just one more physical manifestation. It's just one more of the six senses. It's just one more thing that sort of happens in bodies. It just happens to be sort of a mental stimulus, but it's mostly all happening in this world. And personality is just a function of that. And personality is just a set of coded memories and desires that's all coded chemically in the nervous system. That's gone. When the body dissipates, that's gone. But it's possible that there are swirls in this world, since they co-are, that there are swirls in this world, because there are sub-pieces of this. I mean, it's not... There are pieces in that world still. That's what I mean by an aggregate world. So it's possible that there are swirls in Havaya and in Brihya that are drawn to particular events that are unfolding in physicality. Which conceptually you could say that those swirls are then choosing to incarnate in that body, so to speak. But it's not really not a choice quite on that level. It's not the kind of thinking we think about with choice either. But there could be swirls that are inexorably drawn down. Like one of my teachers used the model of for reincarnation. This was a channel tradition. This is what the spirit world told his teacher. But was that the way it works is there's an incarnation room. And that after somebody dies, before rebirth, you go into the incarnation room and you pick your parents. So whatever you think you wound up with, you chose it. That's in that model. But it's a metaphor. At least I understand it as a metaphor. He takes it pretty seriously. But I hear it as a metaphor. But there is, so in choice, I think there is some sort of inexorable pull on some aspect of wisdom to come down in this particular form, this particular set of physicality. They call each other back into being, both ways, and it's working, and with through love too. It's all. So, having said all of that, I choose to look at it as a choice I make. But I choose to look at my own karma as the. As the conditions that are the conditions that are manifesting in my life, as lawful effects of all my past karma, so to speak, that is unfolding. I think it's unfolding lawfully, even though I can't say I choose to accept that it's happening lawfully, and that I got placed into this, the experiences I have lawfully, partly because I don't see any advantage in thinking it's unlawful. I don't know where I go with that. But I think it is lawful. I don't think we can see it, but it seems to me it's quite likely that it's lawful. That's why I'm choosing to live as if it is. And so I think it's really helpful. I find it really helpful to try and take complete responsibility for my own life in that sense. And not try to blame what's happening in my life on anybody or anything or any set of conditions other than... How it fits in my karma. So I'm willing to work with that. And so I try to lay as little blame on anyone as possible, and not at all always successful in that regard. Just I get lost like everybody else I know. The working phrase is to work with that as a meditative, contemplative tool is, I am the heir of my own actions. You could say karma, but I am the heir of my own actions. My happiness and my unhappiness depend on those actions and not my wishes for myself. You are the heir of your own actions. Your happiness and your unhappiness depend on those actions and not on your wishes for yourself. So, I have to just give you a minute to take that in and see how that feels to you. Just sit with it. I am the heir of my own actions. My happiness and my unhappiness depend on those actions, and not on my wishes for myself. Resist the temptation for now to ask you, how did that go? What do you think about reincarnation and that explanation? But later, sometime you can tell me. So, the more immediate cause and effect material that we can work with, that's what I think is more our purpose here. That's why we're doing this kind of practice, this kind of retreat. So, in order to work with cause and effect, I want to remind you of this. So, I put this up on the board the other day, on here the other day. So there's a linear causality and synchronic causality. When this is that is, from the arising of this comes the arising of that. When this isn't, that isn't. From the stopping of this comes the stopping of that. So one and three are linear, meaning not in time. And two or four are synchronic. They follow. And that's important because there's sort of two parallel things happening. They're both cause and effect, but they work differently. Any given event in the present moment is influenced by both sets of conditions, input from the past and input from the present. So when those two inputs meet, so input from the past and input from the present, when those things come together, they can coexist without interacting so much. That's one possibility. And sometimes they can amplify each other, depending on what's coming in both of those things, and they can cancel each other. So those are all possibilities. So even though generally we'd say that if you act unskillfully, like with anger, so if you act with anger, the result, you're going to get a negative result from that. The negative results could come later. You don't know when it's going to come. It might come as immediate suffering, but depending on the canceling effects, that it's not that it goes away, but it doesn't necessarily, depending on the conditions in the moment, doesn't necessarily manifest. It might be temporarily, so it might, the effect might happen later. And both of those principles, the linear and the synchronic, they both meet in the mind. So in our own minds, moment by moment, both of those principles are acting. And because, in addition, the mind has views and intentions, the mind itself has a causal influence, which furthers both principles. So the mind, where this cause, the past, and this cause, the present, meet, also has its own thing going on, which it becomes causes. So it also has its own causal contribution to the causes that come together in the present moment. And because the mind has a sensory nature, it's affected by the causes it sets off. So it can both set off causes and can be affected by the same causes because it has a sensory nature. So causal principles feed back on themselves. And that can create either a positive feedback loop or a negative feedback loop. So when it creates a positive feedback loop, the mind spins out of control. Which almost all of you have reported happening from time to time. So some things come together, but then so does the mind come together, and then it's off, and that's a positive feedback. Like if there's enough nods, that most of you know what I'm talking about. So I'll tell you when that happened for me. On Sunday night, when we first got here, the very first Sunday, I came into that Sunday with many years in my childhood, a lot of time devoted to watching the Green Bay Packers play football. So it was a big part of, you know, relatively big part of what I liked. It was really, for a certain season, it was a once a week thing. It was a whole way I interacted with my father, let alone the whole world around us. So there was a lot of pleasant associations with it. So there's a lot of with pleasant associations come clinging and grasping, and which then sets off whole chains of things. So. So I got here, and Sunday night, the Packers are having a relatively good season, which is pleasant, so now I get more interested again, because that's pleasant. So I couldn't watch the game, but I'd go up and look on my computer while everybody's arriving. I'd go up and look a little bit, and early in the second half, it was they were losing 24-10 or something, and that's too bad. And then I come down, interact, and I go upstairs. Now they're winning 28-24. 10 minutes later, or something. It's like, wow. You know, now I should get pulled in again. And then talking about Brian witnessed the last bit of it. He came upstairs and. So supposed to be talking to him, but it's that with a minute left, they were winning 36-30. But the other team had the ball, and it's like, the last 5 seconds of the game, they're still winning 36-30. It took 10 minutes, right? That's how football is. And then it pops up on the thing, 38-37, they lost, or 37-36. And I was like, I was completely bummed out for about 24 hours. It's like I really felt lousy about it. I mean, I watched it. It was so funny. I mean, it's like, but it really hit me. I mean, the next morning, I'm sitting here meditating, and thinking about the game. I didn't even see it. I only saw some electrons on the computer screen in my eyes all together. Maybe it was a lie. Maybe they won. Whatever. It's like this huge thing was going on. I was really upset about it. But it was. It's just interesting to watch. Now, when I was about 20 years old, I certainly went through a period. I didn't watch football for many, many, many years, and I thought it was pretty stupid on some level. But when I was 20 years old, I thought, competitive sports is really ridiculous. That's not a good thing. So that's a view. That's a view in the mind. So then, the same causes and conditions. It came when I was 20 years old, at least from the past. I had the same past. Nothing changed about the past. But when those causal conditions from the past and the yearning that could easily be stirred up and the clinging and the suffering, when it met the causal condition, which was a view of mine that professional sports is ridiculous, competition like that is ridiculous, nations are ridiculous, competing nations are ridiculous, I remember I was in Israel at the time, and I was on a kibbutz for the summer, and they showed movies of the Olympics. It wasn't even live. It was like movies of the Olympics. And I just sort of watched how easy it is to manipulate the emotions, watching these movies, and I thought it was so stupid. But with that view, so then, didn't lead to like, I got to, what's the score? Because it just had, the cause of the condition was different, so they canceled out. This condition canceled out that condition temporarily. But there's, but the seeds are there. I mean, the seeds are still there. So I suffered a lot, but then in watching, I mean, now it comes together with talking about all that in the service of giving a talk, and now I'm not suffering. Now I'm really happy about how fun that was to go through the suffering and watch that. And they won they won last Sunday, so they made the playoffs anyways. That game didn't matter all that much now. I mean, maybe that's why I'm not suffering. But now I'm thinking about how to get playoff tickets and whether I can go and whether I can call my friend Max. This is the causal loops. I'm going to call my friend Max. We can go. We went 2 years ago when they were in the playoffs. I don't even know where he is. But it'll be pleasant now. They won. It was really a bummer when they lost 2 years in the playoffs, too. I was there. And it was 3 degrees outside. Bad enough they lost. It was really cold. I got a lot to go get here. Linear causality. So linear causality places limits on what can be done, because it just sort of unfolds. But synchronic, that I mentioned before, that's where free will comes in. So human sacred intention and sacred view and skillfulness make an immediate difference. So there are all sorts of intentions. There are intentions to watch the game, but there are also then intentions to turn it into a Dharma talk is also an intention that comes. That's a more, I think, a more sacred intention than intending to, you know, to have a celebration party when they win the Super Bowl. And I don't even have anybody where I live who watches this Green Bay Packers. It's all alone. It's terrible. Okay. Yeah. When I used to go to Spirit Rock, they were two teachers who talk about baseball all the time in their talks. They would just love baseball. And they would teach everything from baseball, you know. Because as long as you're watching what's happening, it doesn't so matter. The content doesn't matter. And I think that's what I'm going to say here. All right, that's this paragraph. So in practice here, this is what we can watch. And we can watch in order to develop the wisdom and skills that are needed. So what we need to watch is the process involved in how the mind interprets experience rather than the sensory data that they process. Right? We're here working with developing the wisdom by watching, by developing the wisdom and skills needed, is by watching the process involved in how the mind interprets experience, rather than the sensory data that they process. This is primary in one's experience of the cosmos. That's the line from Tinisaro Bhikkhu. This is primary in one's experience of the cosmos. Making that shift, watching the process instead of the content. That's why in that other talk, nothing is worth thinking about. Watching thinking is really valuable. Nothing worth thinking about, at least in this practice. So this is sacred effort. This is a sacred effort to obtain the skills necessary to acquire wisdom. The linear chain works like this, and I'm just going to read it once, and Brian's going to do a whole talk on this later in a couple days. The linear chain of causality that has no start and end. It's a circle. It's called the circle. But so I have to start reading somewhere, but think of it as a circle. Ignorance leads to volition. Volition leads to consciousness. Consciousness leads to the arising of body and mind, in essence. The body and mind leads to having six sense bases. Six sense bases leads to having contact. Contact leads to having feeling. Feeling leads to having craving. Craving leads to having clinging. Clinging leads to becoming. Becoming angry, becoming a fan, becoming. Becoming leads to birth. Birth leads to aging. Aging leads to death. Death leads to ignorance. Ignorance leads to belief. So it just goes on and on. And Brian, I believe, will talk about that. Unless things have changed by the time we get to the time Brian talks. Now, here's a line that says, this is the most important part of the talk, and it's getting late here. But volition, so we're talking about in that chain, which was related to the aggregates we showed you to, the whole key about cause and effect in terms of human beings is all in intention. Intention is where it's at. Volition, the intention behind the act is the key place in terms of looking at how cause and effect then leads into suffering. All karma in terms of human suffering on the mental level, and that's where I'm most interested in thinking about it. So now I'm not talking about, that big question could talk about, you know, well, why did the tsunami hit those folks, you know? I'm not talking about that, no. But that was sort of the first part, and that helped it all. But because it wasn't personal in some ways. But all karma in terms of human suffering on the mental level is determined by intention, certainly. So all this stuff we're going through, oh my God, my life, why isn't it different? The key there is all intention, to look at, that's how the karma starts to unfold in ways that cause problems, or can unfold in ways that lead to happiness. Sometimes the effects are immediate, so When you're sort of grasping for something, it's somewhat unpleasant. You know? Immediately, it's immediate. In some ways, it's immediately unpleasant. And so sometimes, when it arises, it causes immediate suffering. Other times, it happens down the road. The effects are the negative effect. It's going to have a negative effect in some way. Negative, I don't mean bad, but it's going to have an effect that can lead to suffering. Grasping can always lead to suffering. But it might be later because of what I already said about what things are coming together when. So sometimes the effects are over time. Now the main so an illustration of this about intention, the main thing about how karma affects suffering that's in the intention and not in the act. The classic example is a person has a knife in their hand and cuts another person open. So if the person is a doctor, it's the same act. Knife goes into person. So if the person is a doctor and the knife goes into the person with the intention in the mind to heal, even if the person dies, it makes no difference if the person dies, unless there are other things going on and they didn't get enough sleep and this and that, whatever. But if we just look at that moment and that one act. So if the intention was good, there's no negative repercussion in terms of suffering in the mind. At least from that one act. I'm not saying the doctor won't suffer, but that's because there are other factors coming in. But in terms of the ongoing karma and the development, it's not. But if it's a thief who does that, a robber sticks a knife in a person, then there's tremendous negative repercussions on the level of mental suffering that act will eventually cause and bring forth. You said sometimes the effects are immediate, sometimes they come later. Like when you have a loving intention, the open-heartedness is immediately comes with it. You feel that. A Jewish explanation of a Jewish way of looking at this quality of intention, there's a whole category in halacha that matches this exact same understanding, which is it's called lehatchila and bedeavad, sort of before the fact and after the fact. So, if you before the fact, if you are cooking a chicken soup and you happen to be making lunch at the same time, and the chicken soup's on the stove, you're making a milk lunch and a drop, and you're doing stuff puttering around, and a drop of milk falls in the chicken soup. So, if it happened accidentally, then if there's no intention that you did it, then after the act, it's still a kosher soup. It's the same drop of milk. But if you intentionally put a drop of milk in that chicken soup, it's no longer kosher. Mm. It all just depends on the intention. So Jewish law recognizes, even the halakha recognizes this exact principle. So on retreat, we can work with exploring our intentions, their effects on our actions, and the consequences in terms of our own mental anguish and peace of mind. You can just watch this directly, sort of moment by moment as it unfolds. And as I mentioned a little bit earlier, the main way you get a chance to do that is because of restraint. Because on top of whatever else we're teaching you about how to pay attention, restraint is where the possibility for paying attention arises. Because with restraint, you can pay attention to all the choices that get made. That's where, because if you're restraining yourself, normally a choice gets made. You don't notice what the intention is behind it. But because of restraint, there's plenty of opportunities to notice the intention behind something. So, in case you need a list of where you still have choice, even though you're following the instruction. So, note writing, you have choices every time you write a note. You have choices every time you ask a question. You have choices about whether you're going to talk during your job. You have choices. This is not an all exhaustive list, by the way. You have choices about whether you're going to show up in the hall on schedule, whether you're going to show up at all, whether you're going to show up on time, how you're going to conduct yourself in the hall, whether you're going to leave early, whether you're going to sit still, whether you're going to move around. These are all choices you sort of have. And by practicing restraint instead of doing some of these things, like, so you could come late, but if you restrain that, then you And then you show up, and then you feel what's going on. So you restrain your desire not to come for whatever good reason. I'm not worried about the reason. You just the point is to watch the process. So every time there's a choice involved, you have choices about approaching the edge, you have choices about dialing back, when to dial back, when to change practices, when to do the blessings instead of this. So and always looking. So each time you it's not about whether you change or not. If you're about to change from one practice to another and you restrain the change for a moment, then you can say, now, what's the intention behind the change? You know, what's my intention? You're paying attention to the sensation in your leg, and then you're going to switch to the sensation in your in your buttocks. But what's before you make the switch, what's the intention? In all these places with restraint, we can see intention. So I'll tell two stories about that as examples, and then the rest of the material I'll just present another time, because there's plenty to work with already. So one of the first long retreats I did at a place called Santa Sabina, which is a monastery in California. It's just 15 years later, I had a chance to teach there 2 weeks ago. I was very with Sylvia, who I sat on. She was the teacher when I was on retreat. I got a chance to teach there. It's a beautiful setting. So this first time I was at Santa Sabina, with my first long exposure to silence. So I hadn't, just like you're doing, I hadn't spoken. It was 8 days, I think, that I was there that first time. And so two things happened when I entered the world of speech. So the first thing they did, and we'll do stuff like this next week with those who are staying, coming out of silence, we're going to have some exercises. So the first conversation I had, they paired us up to speak to somebody else who was on the retreat. There was another student on the retreat, and they said, you know, just share some of your experience. So I did. I had some pretty wild experiences on that retreat. My first long retreat, everything was new to me. You know, lots of good things the first time. They never matched the first time, right? So I had all of that kind of glow, some of the special things that can happen on a retreat, and I don't actually know how many, this was the old students' retreat, actually, so this guy probably been on a retreat, certainly more than me. I only got to go because Sylvia let me go. Mostly it was people who had been to many retreats, so maybe it must have, anyway, so I just sort of rattled off all this stuff that had happened to me. That's what we were supposed to do. But not exactly. We were supposed to tell him what happened in the retreat. So, the first words out of his mouth was like, "Oh, it's such a hard time. I really wish, I didn't have any of that." And I felt miserable. I felt so terrible. Like my first act of speech had sort of upped his level of uncomfortableness and suffering So I was definitely feeling bad about that. And had I practiced, it would have been possible. I'm not saying you can't know everything that's going to unfold in the future, but had I stopped and examined my intentions, I might have seen part of my intention was to brag. Part of it was to report. That was the assignment. But part of it was like to gush. You know, I wanted to quell over what had happened. But had I thought what was behind there, or had I thought, now how will that sound, or what will that be like for that person, which would all be sort of sacred, moving into sacred intention, like, oh, how will that sound, what will that do? It could have been a different experience. And parallel to that, the second time, I almost spoke. There's a difference. That's where the restraint also helped. So we got to the end of the retreat, and I knew Sylvie because I had a retreat center of my own already, and she knew that I would be interested in that. I was fascinated by the teachers, the truth was, and she knew the teachers who had led that retreat were doing a group interview at the end of the retreat with a reporter who was going to talk to them about what's it like to lead a silent meditation retreat or something. And she said, "Would you like to come in and sit in and listen to the interview?" So to go in the back room with the teachers. This is a big retreat. This is pretty intimate here. But, you know, like to sit in a room with the teachers privately sort of was like, wow, it's really exciting. And so they started interviewing. So I got to do that. I'm all excited about that. And they started, they interviewed the teachers and they're asking about what it's like to lead retreats. And a number of times I noticed I wanted to say something, which would be, I mean, completely inappropriate. I was just like, I was just a guest in the room, you know, altogether. I wasn't really supposed to be there. And so maybe because of the situation, you know, I don't know how much the restraint came because of wisdom and just was like, all right, I'm not going to say anything. So there was restraint. In any case, there was restraint. I didn't say anything. And in not saying anything, I could see all the immediately I could see all the things. Like, I wanted them to see me. I want them to know I'm a retreat leader too. You know, I want them to know I'm smart. You know, whatever. I could see all that stuff. It was all sitting there. And that's what wanted to get spoken out, you know. But being able to see it, it just sort of, it bubbled back down. Because with wisdom, it was like, oh, that's not appropriate. That wouldn't be helpful. You know? And so that's a different, bringing a different mind state in. And restraint was sort of the key to being able to, and the heightened intent. Once, because I was in heightened awareness, I also could notice all that. I wouldn't have necessarily noticed all of those things about myself had I not been cultivating all this practice by restraint and by watching repeatedly. I'll leave you with one closing thought. This was a thought of, I looked up some stuff on intention, and actually one of the teachers on that retreat, it just so happens, a man named Gil Fronsdal. He's a great teacher, some beautiful writing. I read a two-page thing from his book, which is available online for free. He gives all his books away for free. And he said in working with intention, a really good practice is to ask yourself from time to time in your life, what is your deepest intention in life? To really start to frame that for yourself. What is your deepest intention in life? Maybe not every single moment, but as you sit and have moments where you're reflecting on your choices and reflecting on the intentions arising in the mind, see how they fit into this bigger intention that you've set for yourself about the deepest intentions of your life. So, I still read science fiction. But today I thought of it, well, it's just about worlds. I'm really into different worlds. I'm talking about the world, so. Just sit for a minute. But I'm going to reconsider, actually, how much of science fiction I read.